Hi, and welcome to The Horn, a podcast from the International Crisis Group. I'm Alan Boswell. Today we have an episode for you that's a little far from home for us. We'll be speaking with my colleague Diego Darin, Crisis Group's Haiti expert, as well as our Africa director and frequent guest Marithi Mutiga, about the lead-up to and ramifications of Kenya's possible deployment to Haiti. At the end, we also have a quick update for listeners given the fast pace of events. Welcome, Diego and Marithi.
Thank you, Alan.
Thanks, Alan.
So just to let everyone know, because events are moving very quickly, we are recording this on Monday. So Diego, we will start with you, but I just wanted to get a bit of current events out of the way first. The last few weeks, days have been extremely difficult in Haiti, to say the least. Prime Minister Ariel Henry traveled to Nairobi, and when he left abroad, gang attacks surged in an apparent attempt to overthrow him, or at least prevent him from returning. But before we go into those current events, because this is a part of the world we do not normally cover, what does everyone need to understand about the situation at hand and how we got to where we are now?
Well, trying to be brief, since the last peacekeeping operation withdrew in 2017, the gangs have been expanding their power and their foothold. They control mainly Port-au-Prince, the capital, and its surroundings. And they have created two federations, two coalitions, the G9 and the GPEP, that have been battling since 2020 for almost 4 years for the military hegemony in the capital and its surrounding areas. The situation was really dire even before the president, Jovenel Moïse, was killed in July 2021. But since he was killed, there is a breakdown of the state institutions in Haiti. Nothing is working very well except some special units of the police. And the police is completely outmatched by the threat of the gangs that are now able to strike simultaneously on several fronts, as they have been doing in recent days.
So, Diego, what is life like right now for a regular Haitian?
Well, the situation is very, very complicated in the capital. In other parts of the country, well, there is not so much presence of gangs. There are very high rates of poverty, of food insecurity, but the people are not faced with such pervasive violence as there is in the capital. In the capital, the gangs control most of the city. The last UN estimates say that 80% of the capital is under gang control. So people are under the constant threat of being killed, kidnapped, raped, and the last neighborhoods that have not been invaded are under constant threat of being overrun by the gangs.
So how should we think about the state of Haiti right now? Is there a government in Haiti? Has the state collapsed?
Well, there is a government that is headed by the acting Prime Minister Ariel Henry, who was able to take over to be the head of state thanks to the international community that asked him to form a government after President Jovenel Moïse was killed. He was appointed 2 days before the president was assassinated, but it wasn't possible because the president was killed to comply with all the rules and the formalities to become prime minister. But he had the backing of the international community. So since then, he has been heading the government, but people not only in Haiti, but international partners are also calling for him to reach a power-sharing agreement with the opposition to be able to form an electoral council and pave the way to elections. But right now, the state is almost in complete collapse. The police is still working, but the judiciary is not functioning very well. The executive, well, there is only a prime minister, there is not a president. There haven't been elections since 2016. There is no Congress. The last 10 parliamentaries saw their mandate expire in, early last year.
So Haiti is no stranger to foreign interventions. How exactly did the idea of an international mission in this context come about? And what exactly do they expect foreign forces to accomplish? Given what you are saying, it sounds like not only is there the security crisis, but we have something approaching a state collapse inside a massive political crisis as well. So what would be expected of such troops in such a context?
Well, in September 2022, Prime Minister Henri made a decision to raise the prices of fuel, and there was huge demonstrations in the capital and elsewhere in the country. And then some gangs from the G9 coalition in the capital, that is head by Jimmy Charizier, decided to join these demonstrations and blocked the main oil terminal in the country. And this brought the country to a halt because everything works in Haiti with fuel. So after some time that this oil terminal was blocked by Jimmy Charizier and his gangs, as he was demanding the prime minister to step down to make fuel available again, Prime Minister Henri asked the international community to send a foreign force to help the Haitian police to fight the gangs. As currently, the police has less than 10,000 active police officers for a 12 million population to cover all the territory, and they are under-equipped to fight gangs that are increasingly skilled in urban combat and have big arsenals of high-powered weapons.
Okay, Marithi, I'm going to turn to you. Diego is describing, a sort of hellish situation, and one in which I imagine not a lot of countries would be eager to dip their toes into. Why did Ruto sign up for this originally?
So there's a long history and there's a short history. I'll just start with the background. When you go back to the early years of independence and of the fight for independence, actually across much of Africa, the role of the Caribbean was very prominent. Today, when you walk around the streets of Nairobi, you see names, street names such as George Padmore, Marcus Garvey, Ralph Bunche, Du Bois, Ras Makonnen, Cecil Miller. The Black diaspora was extremely active in trying to stimulate conditions that would allow for independence in Africa. The first president of Kenya, Jomo Kenyatta, during his nationalist years, spent time in London, and he was hosted almost exclusively. His time there was heavily sponsored by these Caribbean actors. So naturally, very deep links developed. People like Walter Rodney came to live in East Africa, the prominent writer that wrote the very famous How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. Thurgood Marshall, the first black member of the Supreme Court in the US, he helped to write the Kenyan constitution. So these very deep connections lasted over time, and that's really important to recall. I think the second thing, now coming to the short history, which is a bit related to that older background, is that when Kenya took up its position at the UN Security Council in 2020, this occurred under the leadership of President Uhuru Kenyatta, who happened to be the son of the first president of Kenya. So then at that time, the ambassador to the UN, Martin Kimani, very heavily championed the notion of the A3, the African Union's three representatives, plus one, the one Caribbean representative, echoing that old perspective about Black diaspora and the question of cooperation across the board. So what happened? At that time, the Caribbean members made the point that the plight of Haiti was very worrying, almost catastrophic, as Diego has just described, and there needed to be greater loyalty from Africa to a country like Haiti, which is very important in history. You know, the first slave revolt and the first, basically, a country to free itself by that means. So the short answer is that Kenya then became very actively concerned about the situation in Haiti. I think they unexpectedly offered to send a peacekeeping mission. The US was very enthusiastic about this. And then now you come very quickly to the more prosaic considerations. You know, Kenya wants to be seen as a leader. It wants to have better relations with the US. It might get security sector support. So there are both prosaic reasons, but also very deeply felt historical.
Kenya is, of course, a very vibrant, thriving democracy, open civil society. How has Kenya, and how have Kenyans sort of responded to this pledge for Kenya to send its own forces into what sounds like a very difficult security environment?
Kenyans in the main have responded with bafflement. I think the government has done a very poor job of relaying to the ordinary public what the reason behind the deployment is. I have to tell you that when I engaged for the first time with some of the police that are being deployed, they also are really quite at a loss about where Haiti is, why Kenya is raising its hand. But that doesn't mean there's a blanket opposition. I think there's just curiosity. I think the government can do a better job to relate to Kenyans why they're doing this and what the potential risks are. The second thing, and coming back to your question, which you raise a very important point, Kenya is a democracy. And therefore, it being a relatively open society, everything is debated and there could be political costs. You know, I have watched for many years the deployment of multiple countries in Somalia, where our listeners might know that there's a multinational force deployed to fight the militants of Al-Shabaab. Every time there are Kenyan casualties, there's big debate at home. You know, what are we doing there? Why did this happen? And so this tends to happen in more open societies. So we cannot really underplay the political risks. I think that given the plight of Haiti, it's probably a noble initiative. I think we should not overstate the capacity of those gangs. They're nowhere near the potency of actors like Al-Shabaab, but it's a politically risky move. And I think the authorities need to explain it far better.
Now, of course, there was this court ruling in Kenya that blocked the deployment from moving ahead. The Prime Minister of Haiti was in Kenya just recently, partly to resolve that situation and agree on this reciprocity agreement, as it's called, to pave the way for that deployment. Can you just give us some background to that court challenge? And does it appear like the coast is now clear for Kenya to deploy?
Yes, so some civil society actors moved to court to try and block this deployment. The Kenyan courts, as you know, are quite vibrant and they often tend to clash and knock heads with the executive. And so a High Court judge made this order that before the deployment, you need a reciprocal arrangement and agreement between Haiti and the Kenyan authorities. Over the last few days, as we heard, the Prime Minister of Haiti has been in Kenya to try and put in place this reciprocal agreement. In theory, that should open the door for the deployment. I think the litigants might disagree, but in general, the Kenyan authorities feel that now the coast is clear and they can go ahead.
And Diego, if Kenya has the go-ahead internally, what are the major obstacles now to a force deploying? And frankly, does it still look possible given the situation on the ground right now?
Well, in fact, what we had warned in the report that we released some weeks ago is that the gangs were mulling kind of two options to respond to the arrival of a new foreign force in Haiti. And it was this possibility that has that is materializing right now, that the gangs could join forces and stop worrying each other to fight together in a united front against the security forces in Haiti and the foreign personnel. And the other one is that if they see that a mission is sufficiently highly trained security personnel with a high-end equipment, with helicopters, with armored vehicles, and they feel that they won't be able to face this kind of security force, they might try to adopt a non-confrontational approach, meaning that some of the gang leaders would be ready to engage in discussions to demobilize and disarm. But the main obstacles will be to have at least some successful initial operations. This is very hard because the gang strongholds are located in very densely populated areas where houses are made of very flimsy materials. And so there is a high risk of making harm to civilians in this kind of operations.
And does it look like that what's happening on the ground now is that the gangs are actually uniting, both to overthrow the prime minister, but also to try to prevent a foreign force from deploying?
This is what the most infamous gang leader in Haiti, Cherizier, alias Barbecue, said last week. He claimed that all these concerted attacks were organized by a new alliance that, in fact, this is a non-aggression pact between the two main gang coalitions operating in the capital. In September last year, when Prime Minister Henri was in New York trying to get a United Nations resolution to authorize the mission, Jimmy Cherizier said that rival gangs were coming together in an alliance that he called Vivre Ensemble, which is living together in Haitian Creole. This non-aggression pact just stood like 2 days as the gangs started again clashing with each other. But right now they said that they have come together again, that they know that their common enemy is the government. And in fact, what we have seen is that there have been coordinated attacks by gangs from both the G9 and the GPEP, both coalitions that have been warring for control of the capital for years.
Diego, can you go into a bit more detail about how we should think about these gangs? Are they purely criminal enterprises? Are they actually political actors in their own way? For those of us sitting on the other side of the world, how should we look at these gangs and understand them?
According to United Nations estimate, there are roughly 300 gangs operating in Haiti, most of them operate in the capital, and they have regrouped and joined one of the two coalitions, the G9 or the GPEP, that were created in 2020. In fact, the G9 was created with the support of some government officials of President Jovenel Moïse, who was killed in 2021. So the gangs traditionally have had links with the elites in Haiti. And this comes back to the dictatorship of the Duvaliers when they created the Tonton Macoutes, which were a paramilitary wing that repressed all kind of dissent to their rule. And since then, the gangs have been emerging in Haiti as a tool for the elites to serve their own interests, both to politicians, to be able to secure good results during the elections, or for business persons in several ways. But for some years now, for 3 or 4 years, the gangs have been increasingly independent as they have been searching for new ways to fund themselves, for example, with the kidnapping that has become one of their main economic resources. And right now, in these two gang coalitions, there is the G9 that claims that they are not gangs, that they are revolutionary forces. And there is the GPEP that is more pervasive. They now control much more territory than the G9, and they are not scared to acknowledge that they use, for example, kidnapping as a resource.
Thanks for that, Diego. So, Marithi, I'm going to turn back to you now that we have quite a picture of what the Kenyan police would be up against. Now, I think it's fair to say that police in Kenya don't have the best reputation. Meanwhile, Kenya does have a peacekeeping track record, quite a long one, but it is mixed. Kenyan peacekeepers just pulled out of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and I don't think that mission is widely seen as a success. Why does the security establishment in Kenya think this is a winnable mission?
Yeah, so Alan, you're right that the record is patchy to a certain degree, but a couple of things. One is that very importantly, the authorities have decided to deploy what's called the General Service Unit, which is the most elite and best trained of the security forces. A lot of them receive their training abroad. They generally are quite effective. They are, for example, the first responders when there's an attack by militants in Nairobi. They're also the most experienced in dealing with urban combat, and therefore, they therefore chose not to deploy, for example, the army. I think the army would contest a bit the notion that the perception of the deployment in the DRC, because they chose not to fight and engage the M23. They instead chose to negotiate with them and actually succeeded in pushing them back quite a bit. But the authorities expected them to go in. I think there was a total failure of communication. They expected them to go in and engage in hot combat, which did not happen. So yes, the record is patchy. But they would point to, deployments in the former Yugoslavia, in Liberia, in Sierra Leone, Somalia, to say that they have the experience for this. But as I said, this seems a very risky move. It's a very risky context. It's a very difficult one. And if you start having people returning in coffins, that will be political dynamite. So I think we have to wait and watch. They are currently undergoing training. I think just to add very quickly that it's very important, given the history of Haiti and the disastrous reputation of foreign interventions, it's very important that they demonstrate discipline, that they avoid the kind of sexual assaults that really tarnish the names of past UN interventions. So I think human rights training will be absolutely critical.
Do we have any sense yet from Kenya if they see themselves taking on the gangs directly or, such as the Congolese example, perhaps doing something instead that looks like securing important institutions and infrastructure and maybe seeing if it can play a role in helping resolve a political crisis? What have you heard from Kenyans in terms of how they're seeing this?
It's a great question, Alan. And in fact, the background of this is that initially the Kenyans had agreed to offer what's called in the jargon a static force, which would mean that one that goes in, defends the sort of facilities that Diego talked about, for example, the oil terminal, defends some highways, and therefore frees the Haitian police to engage directly with the gangs. But of course, the Haitian police is very weak. It said sometimes to work in partnership with the gangs. And so the mission then evolved into a kinetic force. That is to say that they are supposed, unlike in Congo, to actually go and confront the gangs. They tend to say that we should not overestimate the capacity of the gangs. But then, in reality, the gangs are at home. Some of them are political actors. Some of them actually say that they are less predatory than others and therefore have some public support. So it will be a very delicate and tricky mission. Can I just add, though, that one of the positive things in a very grim picture is that there's a lot of Haitian public support for a potential deployment, partly driven by the desperation that exists in an ideal world. This deployment needs to be accompanied by a political effort to engage with the gangs that might agree to put down their arms rather than engage in direct combat. But that's not the world we live in, clearly. And I think it will be a very challenging mission.
And just quickly, are there any signs of cold feet from Kenya? I imagine watching the events in Haiti from Nairobi might give some shudders at the moment.
So, Alan, my own view is that this whole process has been mishandled to a very great extent. The discussion has been going on for many, many months. The UN authorized this mission in October 2023, but the deployment did not go ahead very quickly. And there are a number of reasons for that. First, I think, and most importantly, Diego and his colleagues have pointed out that the US in particular needed to use its leverage over the leaders of Haiti to try and craft a political coalition. If they had done that, then it would have been less risky to deploy, because the Haitian elite and Haitian opposition point out that Ariel Henry's legitimacy is threadbare. Nobody elected him. He's in office essentially illegally because he should have left office. Elections should have taken place on the 7th of February. So most missions of this sort, you go in to help government institutions. You're in a context now where there is no government with clear legitimacy in Haiti. So I think the US was remiss not to have done that more quickly. I think the second thing is that so much time has been spent discussing operational details. When we get readouts, it's always about the money. It's always about the trust fund, which the UN is supposed to manage. It's about what the role of the UN will be. I think this sort of foot dragging has been a real disappointment, because then, you've ended up with a context where, particularly after February 7th, as Diego described, the security situation has become quite fluid. This is a critical and important mission, above all for the Haitians, because they are suffering so much. But also in the broader context, we know that UN security arrangements, for example, with large peacekeeping missions, are on the way out. They're on the way out in Mali, in the DRC, it's very hard to conceive of such a mission taking place. So this might be the future. But unfortunately, it seems already to be collapsing even before it begins. I'm not saying that it won't work. I think more work needs to be done to make it feasible. But I think it's a huge lost opportunity.
And Diego, to advance further off of some of what Marithi was saying there and based off of some of what you have written for us at Crisis Group, you have described a deteriorating security situation, but as discussed, it's also a political crisis. How does a deployment of a foreign force help resolve that political crisis, which seems at least as fundamental as the security one?
Well, there are two kind of opinions on how the arrival of a mission could have an impact on the political crisis. There are people that say that as the security situation could be progressively start to improve, the political actors would be more willing to engage with the Haitian government, the Haitian interim government, to reach an agreement on how to go to elections. But what many fear and what the opposition, in fact, is saying is that they fear that an international mission could prop up the government of Prime Minister Ariel Henry, who would be then free to organize elections as he and his allies want, well, maybe favoring some kind of party or particular individual in the elections. What we had said at Crisis Group is that the right sequencing would have been to have a political agreement between the Prime Minister and at least a critical mass of the opposition, mostly the political parties that want to run in the elections, so as to have an agreement on the rules for organizing the elections, and then having the multinational mission on the ground with a new transitional government. However, right now, the security situation is so dire and is deteriorating at a high pace, so it is really urgent for the Haitian police to have the backing of a foreign force to be able to at least fend off the simultaneous attacks they are facing from the gangs. And then, well, hopefully the international community will press harder both on Henri, the Prime Minister, and on the opposition for both sides to make enough concessions to reach a power-sharing agreement in which Henri will not be the only one to make the important decisions in the transitional period.
And would the opposition forces welcome a Kenyan deployment at this time?
What we saw after the Security Council authorized the mission last October is that nobody in the opposition said anything against this deployment because, well, they know that most Haitians welcome and are in favor of a foreign force coming to Haiti as they see this as the last resort option to be able to have some kind of a normal life in the near future. So the opposition hasn't been opposing the deployment, but they certainly say that the international community is making a mistake, not pressing harder on the interim government to make more concessions, to share power with the opposition before the mission comes in, as they see, well, Ariel Henry as not only a political leader that doesn't have legitimacy, but also a head of state that hasn't been able to do much for 2.5 years since he became not only the acting prime minister, but in fact, the acting president of the country.
And we have seen other countries recently say that they are also willing to send in troops as well, right? But this still looks like it'll be mostly a Kenyan-led operation.
Well, yes. Initially, Haiti asked for a force of 1,500. The Kenyans have committed 1,000 police officers. Benin, it's important to say, a French-speaking country, said they would be sending 2,000 police officers. So this makes a force of 3,000 plus other contributions from other African and Caribbean countries.
It's very important also for greater Caribbean ownership to be apparent. I think that, the opposition may not have opposed this deployment, but we've seen some civil society voices say, you know, this might be like some sort of black colonialism that, you know, we had UN intervention, we had US intervention, and now the US is encouraging Africans to come in and do what they did in the past. It's probably not a fair comment, but it's a sentiment that exists, particularly in the large Haitian diaspora. So I think greater Caribbean involvement will be important.
Diego, I'm just wondering, given the events of the last week, the last few days, does it look like to you that the window might be closing to deploy a foreign force? Because clearly, even if there is a go-ahead, it'll still take time to actually organize the logistics and financing to get troops on the ground.
Well, there is a risk that if the gangs continue attacking state institutions and critical infrastructure, maybe this window won't be open for so long, as the situation is really deteriorating by the day. If the gangs continue these large-scale attacks, they could be in control of all the capital in some weeks, maybe. I think that one scenario that Barbecue, the gang leader, and other gangs are heading towards is be able to have the Haitian state at their feet and negotiate some kind of amnesty before the force comes in.
Hmm. And is there a world in which the gangs actually take over the state?
For now, it wasn't their objective at all, as they are not motivated by political ideas or ideologies for almost all of them. But they are motivated mostly by greed and having more and more power, but not political power. They don't want to rule the country. Most of the gang leaders are young men who were born in very violent environments and for whom the only possibility to put bread on the table and have some respect from the people that surround them was to join the gangs. So until now, we hadn't really considered the fact that gangs would be trying to take the control of the state. But as they see that the mission will be heading, well, hopefully soon to Haiti, this is clearly an option right now.
So Marithi, I think given how fluid everything is, it remains, you know, radically unclear which direction this goes. But regardless, having watched these negotiations take place, it's been quite a roller coaster. What has gone wrong and has anything gone right?
So it's a good question, Alan, and I would say two things. One is that this has been very carefully watched at the UN for the reasons I mentioned earlier. Some had hoped rather optimistically that it might be one of those future models because it's very hard to conceive of peacekeeping missions. China and Russia were a bit skeptical, according to our colleagues, but they sat on the fence because they didn't want to be seen to be blocking something that had been requested by the Haitian government and that seems a big priority for the African Union for the reasons we discussed. What has gone wrong? I don't mean to be too harsh on the Americans, but this, I think, was their ball. This is important from the American domestic perspective for a couple of reasons. There's the question of immigration and the concern that, if for example, there's greater security, that less Haitians will arrive in the U.S. So it's a matter of domestic political import. It's a big priority for the Congressional Black Caucus, which is very important for the Biden administration politically. And third, you know, it could be a success and a win if it works. I think it's disappointing. It's not so easy, but many in Haiti perceive that the Americans were best positioned to craft a political compromise, and that didn't happen quickly enough. Maybe they tried, but it didn't happen quickly enough. I think Kenya also could have pressed a little more and a little harder. I don't mean to be unfair, you know, I know behind the scenes a lot of work has been going on, but the results have been dismal. I think that, you know, we obviously have to wait and watch. It's very hard to predict and project, but I think we have to recall that the Haitian people are desperate. They want this mission. I think it needs to be handled delicately, but of course, we can't just give up, you know, given that, as Diego has described, it's one of the most desperate contexts in the world.
Hi, everyone. Now, we are going to do something a bit unusual since we recorded this originally on Monday. It is now Wednesday. The Haitian Prime Minister left Nairobi and then has been unable yet to make it back to Haiti. My colleague Renata Segura, Crisis Group's Deputy Director for Latin America, has a quick update for us. Renata, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what do we know about the whereabouts of the Haitian Prime Minister, and what might this mean for the future of this Kenyan-led mission that we've been talking about?
Yeah, so the Haitian Prime Minister was sort of MIA since we last saw him on Friday after signing the agreement in Nairobi. But then it was leaked that he actually has spent the week in the U.S., apparently first in New York and then in Washington. And then late last night, it surfaced that he has landed in Puerto Rico. I mean, clearly what he's trying to do is to reach Haiti in some way. Both of the main airports in Haiti are at this time closed. He had hoped to go to Dominican Republic and maybe fly in a helicopter, but the DR has not been agreeable to that plan, and the aerial space between the two countries is closed at the moment. So he is in Puerto Rico. We have no clarity of what exactly the plan might be. We imagine he might be thinking about reaching Haiti by boat, but that is just a speculation of, you know, considering that he is now in the Caribbean itself. Since he has been gone, and with the ramping up of violence, both against state institutions and jails, and other kinds of places that the gangs had not been sort of targeting in recent weeks, what we have seen is some pressure to take advantage of this situation by some political actors in Haiti to try to create a government without Henry being part of it. And from what we are hearing, there might be pressure coming from CARICOM and even perhaps the United States, although that is not being made official, have Henry actually resign. This seems to be a crucial part of what might happen in the next few weeks. A big part of the problem in Haiti has been this inability to build a transitional government that is considered legitimate by the majority of the population and that brings together political parties, but also groups like the Montana Agreement, civil society group that have been very, very opposed to Henry being in government. With Henry out and the change of the situation in the ground, it might be that the moment is arising in which these other political actors could sign an agreement and make this transitional government happen. If that was the case, if that was to happen, there would be a much stronger political support for the mission to move forward. Obviously, right now, the security situation is such that the mission by itself would be hard-pressed to land in the country and be able to do what had been planned. So it is very likely that it's going to need to both accelerate the plans that it had. I think waiting a few more months to get to Haiti is clearly not going to be an option, but maybe also get reinforcements of some sort. We have heard from Washington that they are not willing to send Marines at this particular point anytime, although that is something that might change if the situation deteriorates. But there's also speculation about the possibility of contractors being sent to help the mission sort of at least arrive and get on the country, getting in there and start organizing for the full deployment that hopefully happens in not so long. So I think that's what we're waking up today to. You know, this pressure, political pressure on Henry to resign, and the possibility of a transitional government being created without him.
Thanks to all three of our guests. The Horn is a production of the International Crisis Group. Once again, I'm Alan Boswell, and our producers are Mae Francis and Ida Holly-Nambi.